Testing.
Maybe in the way that you later decided that the best way for unions to get what they wanted.
Of course, I never favored the first Mullen general strike, never. Before or after it.
Maybe I could just start by doing some background. You said you were born in California, but you came here very young.
Back to California, June 16, 1894.
And you came to Seattle with your parents?
When I was 4 years old, my mother's sister. My father preceded us years away. And I've been here ever since.
What kind of work did your father do?
My father was an auctioneer at one time in California, but he was primarily engaged in carpet repair work. Furniture, things of that kind.
Did he do that usually working for other people or for himself?
Usually for himself. A small individual shop.
And did your mother work outside of the home? Or?
No, not on the whole. She did not until we were 13 or 14 years old. Then in the summertime, she might work a little bit. Otherwise, she never worked.
Did they discuss politics at home? Was that something that was talked about a lot?
My father did, but not my mother.
And were you included in those conversations?
Oh, yes, yeah. After I reached the age of 12, 13 years of age.
Was he generally, sympathetic to the labor movement, or how would you classify him?
I think he was sympathetic, but the labor movement at that early day was in its infancy. That would be around 1906, 8, 9, 10, in that area of time.
So when politics was discussed, it wasn't frequently a question of labor, but other types of
no, politics
events?
In general, that's right.
Mm-hmm. You don't remember what paper they read, do you?
In Seattle? Oh, yeah, they read. My father was an embedded reader. He subscribed to the Star, Times, and PI, all three papers here.
Uh-huh. And you went to high school, I think, to the Broadway High School.
Uh-huh. 1909.
And went through 10th grade?
I left there my sophomore year because I had to go to work for the family. It was very, very bad financial shape, so I quit and went. To work. And I did odd jobs in warehousing and with a typewriter company and et cetera and et cetera. And then finally I wound up getting a job in the laundry industry. And then I did very well financially in there because I was driving, working on a commission, and I was making $80, $90, $100 a week. Which at that time was a lot of money. And then I would build brutes, build them up and then sell them off, $100 a month and rebuild, sell back the company for $10 or $12 for one. So I was doing very good as a laundry driver. And then the World War came along in 1917 and I enlisted immediately and went to San Diego and trained there at Balboa Park in North Island. And then I came home right at the end of my training and was married here. Left the next day, went back and immediately to Europe. And I was on the squadron in the Naval Air Corps up at Killingholm, which is right across from the Kiel Canal on the North Sea. Afterwards, I spoke 12 miles from there at Bridlington, England, as a delegate to the British Trade Union Congress from the American Federation of Labor in 1949. But I stayed in the labor movement after 1926, from then on.
Sort of an understatement that you stayed in the labor movement.
That's right.
So, you were in the Army until when? From the Navy?
I was in the Navy until the armistice. And they used the camp or the station where I was on, which was supplying and defending destroyers and submarines with gasoline and zeppelins that were in the earlier days coming across the North Sea and down across England bombing. They used it for prison exchange camp because we were right straight across the North Sea from the Kiel Canal. So that permitted us to get away from Europe early. And we went right down to Southampton, picked the Leviathan up that was in dry dock, then over to Liverpool in the Brest, France. And then I landed, I think, because if I remember right, on December the 11th or 13th of 1918, the year the war ended.
So you came over to the East Coast then, is that right? You landed,
I landed at Newark, yeah, across from the port of Newark.
Right. And then did you come straight out to Seattle?
No, I had enlisted, so I had to get a discharge. And I made a petition for discharge because they were discharging them right and left then. And that was recognized. And I came right straight home. If I remember right, I came back around January the 11th or 12th of 1919.
So you actually were in the city when the general strike took place?
In Seattle, yes.
Do you remember beforehand people talking about the general strike and what it was going to be like, and what did you expect it to be like before it actually took place?
No, I wasn't here long enough ahead of it for that.
When you came back, did you come back taking up your job driving to the laundry?
Yes, I was entitled to my job back, but the fellow that had my job was about 63 or 4 years of age. He was a good friend of the family. And I wouldn't take his job because I said, I get a job easier than he can. So I took another job, another laundry. And he stayed on his job. But there was no, I took part in no preliminary talk about the general strike at all.
Did you have any, do you remember thinking about what you thought it would be like to have a general strike?
Oh, I knew pretty much what it'd be like, sure. I was of the opinion that it was so gigantic in its makeup that it was impossible to administer it, and that it would run away with itself, which it turned out to do. So I advocated at the laundry drivers union meeting that they not participate in it, and was successful in voting not to do it. Then the general teamsters and some of them had voted, so then it reached the attention of the national office. And they sent in a national representative from San Francisco, and he came in and ordered them to carry out the contracts and go back to work. So that was practically the story.
So the laundry workers never went out at all?
Laundry drivers.
The laundry drivers.
No, they did not go out at all.
See. And do you remember from whose control the strike was under when it was declared the general strike?
Well, it was the boilermakers primarily initiated it, and was under the control pretty much of Jimmy Duncan, the Central Labor Council, who was Secretary of the Labor Council, afterwards a candidate for mayor of Seattle, or just easier than that, and later was a member of the school board for a number of years. But the most direction was attributed to Duncan, Doyle, and people like that, and the Watermakers Union. Those that made up the shipyard structure.
Did you feel it was being run by union men and not by IWW people or anything like that?
No, I don't think there was any IWW people connected with it I knew of. I think there was a lot of radical people that could not see the long pull at all and was felt that they could tie the city up and win everything, which they couldn't do. And in my opinion, nobody envisioned for one second would support it to do it. And the history of it proved that, of course.
Why do you think it happened that so many people went out in support of another union's demand?
Just momentum.
Momentum of the time?
That's right.
But the laundry drivers worked straight through
No, I think some of the laundries shut down temporarily because of agitation and so forth. But the drivers themselves were not, never voted to go on strike.
Mm-hmm. How, during the strike, how did you get information about what was going on?
Well, they issued bulletins and things like that.
The strike bulletin?
To the personnel that was on strike.
Did you eat in any of the gigantic dining halls that they set up during that time? Do you remember them at all?
No, I don't remember them at all. I never participated in them, and I don't remember them even, no. You mean where they fed the strikers?
Right. Did you see any violence during the strike?
No, I didn't see any violence.
Were fear of any violence?
Not anymore, in my opinion, is nominal compared with many other strikes in the early days.
Do you remember when the army came in to the city?
The army was ordered into the city at the request of Mayor Hansen of Seattle, but it was perfunctory. There was nothing for them to do at all, because business was practically shut down for 2 or 3 days. There was no violence on the streets or anything like that. But in my opinion, it was a means of momentum for publicity for Mayor Hansen of Seattle, and he took advantage of it, that's all.
Why did the strike end? You think, why did the general strike?
Because the bottom fell out of it. No accomplishment. The shipyard revolved around the shipyard. The war was over, so the shipyards could shut down for the next 4 or 5 or 6 years. It wouldn't have bothered them. That's why they couldn't win it on their own. And then a lot of them got into their head that they could paralyze other industry, not at all related to the shipyard. There'd be a tremendous pressure to settle it. There was not. But the shipyards in themselves were going out of business. There was nothing more for them to build ships for it. No reason.
So it was that there were no results coming that caused the general strike to fold, sort of?
It folded of its own momentum, and the fact that the industry employing the people where the strike was located could shut down indefinitely. The only people that were being hurt were those organizations of labor not working in that shipyard field. Their employment was disturbed, of course. But those employers were not concerned with the building of ships either. So that it had a tremendous false premise from the getaway, in my opinion.
How did the strike affect labor afterwards? Did most people that you knew consider it a failure or a success? Or?
Oh no, I think the overwhelming percentage figured it a miserable failure, because the Union Record, which was owned by the labor movement, printed on its front page, "Where do we go from here?" That told the story right there. Nobody connected with it knew where the hell they were going or how to get there either. So it just failed with its own momentum.
Did the strike have a significant effect on either you or the city?
I know it didn't on me. I don't know about the city. I felt exactly the same way about the general strike afterwards as I did before it. And then later on, when I broke the strike, general strike in Oakland, when I was on the international payroll by issuing orders at San Francisco not to participate in it, I broke it.
So you've sort of known for a view of that strikes are a last resort, and it's much better to be able to negotiate your gains.
Would you
say
you can?
Did the general strike have any effect on that, or had you already developed that attitude before the strike even took place?
You mean in the laundry drivers union? Or where?
Well, generally,
there was no such an issue being developed at all, because of its own strength, and due to the war, the shipyards had to operate. There was a tremendous demand for ship construction, ship repair, and etc. So as long as the war went on, there was no agitation for or against the general strike. everybody was able to get top wages for the times and conditions. But the minute that that war ended, the need for construction of ships stopped. It was absolutely a useless strike, in my opinion.
And did that, the failure of the strike affect at all how you thought about strikes, or had you already pretty much decided that strikes were a last?
No, it made no impression on me, any lasting impression. I didn't feel a bit different after it was over than I did before it started, as history will prove that I went into the Laundry Drivers Union in spite of the overwhelming percentage, even the Teamsters voting for it, and opposed it, stating that it would accomplish no objective and would be detrimental to the long pull of labor. And of course, that's the way it ended.
In what way was it detrimental to labor in this city?
Because it proved that in anything of that nature that you do in your lifetime, there's two things you can do. You can prove your strength and your weakness. And it proved the weakness. Exactly that.
Did it prove the weakness by showing that a general strike couldn't accomplish anything, or by showing that labor couldn't pull off the general strike?
Well, it demonstrated, number one, that there was no organized structure within the labor movement to carry a strike long enough for it to have any effect, if there were any effect possible. That it demonstrated quickly, because those that were leading the strike did not have it financially operating under the best conditions. People were crying and wanting to go back to work that needed to go back, and a great mass of the people that were in the strike couldn't see where the hell they were involved. So it fell of its own weight right there, from the standpoint of publicity as well as anything else.
I'd like to ask you about a few of the people who were involved. You mentioned Ole Hansen before.
He was mayor of the city and had been considered favorable to labor in a political sense, but that had really no effect on me either, because all my life in the labor movement, I have opposed political action in labor as a fundamental of its operation. You have to use political action. You have to protect your interests in the state legislature, Congress, and so forth. But basically, I believe in an economic labor movement, and not a political labor movement such as the British Trade Union Congress and the English labor movement.
So you had never counted on Hansen anyhow, as you wouldn't count on any politician, would you say?
At that time, I had no personal contact with Hansen. I had been away in the service. And the strike is coming on within a day or two when I got back from service.
How about Anna Louise Strong? Did you know her?
I knew her afterwards, and I knew her brother, and I knew her father, who was a minister. But Anna Louise Strong, I didn't know too well. She was a very, very able woman, but in my opinion, completely a theorist. No practical training, and knew nothing, in my judgment, of the labor movement. She just got one of those, get out of the cloud, and they're floating.
How about Harry Ault? Did you know him?
I knew him very, very well. Harry Ault was editor of the labor paper, the Union Record, and a pretty able fellow. And he had an assistant there who later became a owner of KIRO television station. He was a pretty able fellow. But in my opinion, Harry Ault was not a qualified leader of labor. He in his field, he could write labor and times and conditions surrounding it, but from a standpoint of guiding the destiny of a labor movement, he was an editor, not a labor representative.
Did some people think that he should be in a position of guiding, did they look to him for leadership?
Not that I know.
How about Jimmy Duncan?
Jimmy Duncan had a great deal of experience in labor. But in my opinion, Jimmy Duncan was looking too far ahead always and not being able to accomplish it at the time in question, in every phase of his labor association. He was always at the extreme end of vision, for instance, of Gompers and people in the American labor movement. What Jimmy was advocating to be done today might be practical 5 or 10 or 15 years from now, but not at the time. So it was just as damaging if it wasn't practical at the time of its application as if it had no application at all.
How about, did you come in contact with members of the IWW, especially when you, I guess, when you were just beginning? Were they still active?
Well, they were active, very active, yes. And I rubbed shoulders with them in contact in my association with labor. But you see, I didn't get into the national labor picture until 1926. I was strictly on the local field. And by the time I got into the national labor movement, then the futility of what these people had been expounded had been demonstrated, and they were not in any position of leadership to have a say.
How about, I understand that in the lumber camps around Seattle, they were pretty well respected because of their fight over the blankets and conditions.
Well, over conditions in the lumber industry. And again, I think that they accomplished a great deal for the future of labor, even though it was not practical in its application at the time. And I think that what they did, the things that they advocated and the procedure they followed, scared hell out of a lot of employers. And they were, it had the effect of having them take a good second look at it and keep it a little bit in advance of what normally they would have done. For that purpose, I think they served the purpose.
So they made it easier for the rest of the labor movement to talk with employers because they had the IWW as a...
Yeah, legitimate labor, use of legitimate in the sense of recognized labor in the American Federation of Labor, was a damn sight more preferable than the advocacy of the things that the IWW has contended for and the methods they used to secure it.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the labor movement today?
How do I feel about the what, sir?
Well, do you think that generally the labor movement is moving in directions that you think are good or...
I think there's an apathy in labor. I think they're acquiring things too easily in labor by virtue of conditions that surround it, and that they haven't had to fight for it like they did in the earlier days of labor. Now, therefore, I'm somewhat of the opinion that we don't have the militancy down deep inside the heart and bowels of the labor movement that we have. Now, in my opinion, that the least setback to labor over any area of operation that will come back into life again. And then you will get that momentum of terrific agitation within labor of economic action.
Do you see that possibly coming soon? Do you see it on the horizon, or is that...
No, I don't see it in the immediate, because I don't see labor losing any strikes, for instance. And I don't see how it could possibly occur until they reach the point where they're having to fight to maintain what they have or advance. But when you've got the steel industry 100% organized, the automotive industry organized, and the telephone company, if you name them one right after another, at the old days you had to fight to get them, until that situation changes, I don't see no great change coming in the labor organizing field. Then you've got the National Labor Relations Board Act, which has completely changed the whole status of organizing. Because the jurisdictional rights of the American labor movement were taken away by the government when they instituted the National Labor Relations Act. Now there's no control over the organizing pattern except as somebody within the AFL-CIO might interfere with the jurisdiction that they allocate. They can only do it, though, in the sense that it wouldn't meet with their approval. But, the Teamsters right now, for instance, the carpenters could go over here and organize longshoremen tomorrow. They'd hold an election, a political election. And if they won it, then the jurisdiction grants to the American Federation of Labor mean nothing. and the government would support the winner regardless of anything else. So therefore, in my judgment, you're losing a lot of the close-knit control of organization within the American labor movement.
I'd like to ask you about a couple other movements that have happened in the last few years. What did you think of the civil rights movement?
As it pertains to black people?
Or any minority people?
I believe 100% in it, of course. I think you've got to follow simple lines of being able to accomplish it by and a policy that's acceptable to the great mass of the people if you're going to get your results through elective process. If you're going to get them through an organizational structure of labor, that's something else. Through boycott or something of that kind. Then you can use economic action, a purchasing power and so forth. But I think that it made such tremendous strides in it that they're not going to be stopped in any sense. It may take a little bit longer than some people would like, but you make your progress subject to its acceptance, and a great majority of acceptance, by whether or not the public supports it.
This is off my topic, but I can't resist asking, having this chance. What did you think of the Supreme Court decision that came down 2 or 3 days ago saying that seniority systems, although they agreed that they probably did discriminate against minorities, were still not unconstitutional?
I don't think they are unconstitutional. I think it would have been a serious blunder for the court to have ruled otherwise, because there's thousands of people who have secured their seniority strictly by working on their jobs. And minority question never entered into it in any way, shape, or manner. Now minorities are struggling to get the same active attention that these people in the Teamsters, let us say, fought for under economic strike action. They secured it. Minority didn't get it for them. Not one of them had anything to do with getting it for them. Now, out of the process of acquiring these objectives, they established their seniority. Now, to walk in here and take away from them 2, 6 years, 8 years, 10 years, 15 years seniority they fought for and accomplished through organizing action, because minorities couldn't get it. Why punish them as individuals? Therefore, I think the Supreme Court was 100% right on it. Now, I don't think you can discriminate it or should discriminate against minorities. But you take firemen and policemen. There are plenty of those places that it was not the fault of the individual that went into the police department that he got greater seniority than someone that didn't even get to take the examination. Now to penalize him after he's been in there, perhaps even up to the point where he'd shortly retire, in order to come in and move minorities in here and give them seniority they never actually performed, but based it upon the fact that they couldn't get in at that time, even though they might never have passed the examination if they applied for it. You don't know that. Those questions are all interwoven there. And I think the United States Supreme Court has visioned it as a practical matter, no theory at all. Now, there's one way for the minority to accomplish it is to join unions and to get the same work on the same level of choice as the rest of them do in the union. But how you're going to give them 8, 10, 15, 20 years preference on the seniority question, that the individual who's affected by it had nothing to do with, I can't understand that at all. That's not practical.
How did you feel about the student anti-war movement in the 60s?
I personally have strong opinions on it. I believe if we have a selective service system, it should be applied, regardless of race, color, creed, money, or anything else. So I'm not in sympathy with the people who used it as in my judgment, in many instances, as an ulterior motive to avoid military service. That I'm 1,000% opposed to. Now, I believe, personally, I strongly believe in the conscripted army, because I don't believe that under the human equation that everything that we do revolves, that there's enough people who, of their own voluntary action, make right decisions in behalf of the country. And I think they'll be looking where their best interest from a dollar standpoint is, and that's not military service during a war. Now, I don't believe in the abolition of anyone's individual rights, except if the country's involved. Now, under our democratic form of government, if a war is declared, maybe they made a mistake, I don't know. But you have to have some procedural method to follow to determine whether or not a mistake was made. And that's through the process of the judiciary.
Classified it as a movement that you didn't support in any way.
No, I don't say that I didn't support it anyway. I believe in the right of, I believe in the First Amendment of the Constitution, and I believe in the right of freedom of speech, and I believe in all of those things. But I believe there's a place that you can't take it under your individual self to write the law on it either. And for that reason, I do not subscribe to many of the things that they did. I do believe in them, meeting on campus or pavilions or opera houses or anywhere else to express themselves, as they do, for instance, in London and Hyde Park. But there's a point where you have to stop unless you're going to breed revolution. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe in revolution, even though we were born in revolution. We've made our progress since then out of evolution, though.
How do you feel about the women's movement today?
I believe in the women's movement 1,000%. I am skeptical of whether or not, in the process of its application, where it hasn't brought on us a tremendous amount of failure to properly rear children and so forth. Kids coming home from school, the mother and father both working, and the kids having nothing to do and drifting into a pattern of association by reason. I think it's been a serious injury to the welfare of our country. But on the rights of individuals to seek employment, get equal wages, all that sort of thing, I believe in 100%.
What organizations have you been a member of since you first joined union? Have you been a member of other political or fraternal or religious organizations?
Well, I became a member of the Elks Lodge and was elected the exalted ruler of Seattle Lodge of Elks. I think the year I was there was the 13th or 14th largest in the United States. Then I was named district deputy of the Elks, which is one of the highest grades that can be given from the top. And but then I got out of that because of the tremendous amount of time that my labor worked on could write. And the same thing, I did it on other phases. Any of those appointing positions, usually I took them in order to settle a dispute as to appointment. I did it, for instance, on the Board of Regents at the University of Washington. Now, the governor had promised labor that they put one member, I think it was, on the Board of Regents. They sent him in 10 or 15 names, and he wouldn't agree to any of them. So then they sat down and he said, if you'll name somebody like Dave Beck, I'll appoint him. They agreed immediately, and that's how I went on the Board of Regents. But I told them when I went on, I'm not going to stay on here, because I'm going to stay on here long enough to see if this thing cannot be worked out to where a satisfactory solution with time will permit me to retire from it and the issue be disposed of. I did the same thing at the Washington State Parole Board under Governor Martin at Walla Walla. I didn't want to go on the parole board. Took a lot of my time. It paid a per diem salary or something. And I used to sign the checks and turn them back to the prison board because it wouldn't take the money for the work. And on all of those issues, I felt that way about it.
I guess the number of organizations that you've been in would take a long time to
go
through.
No, I haven't been in too many organizations. I could find 95% of my time to my work in the labor movement from 1914 in a minor way. But from the time that I became real active, around 1924 or 5, but just before the Seattle Convention of the National Teachers, I've given most of my time. I've turned down job after job after job in the business world at twice the salary labor was paying me. Twice the salary. I turned down assistant to Eric Johnson as head of the National Motion Picture Academy set up. $15,000, $20,000 a year more than labor is paying me. I turned down a position with Scorus that would have paid me $25,000 more than I was paying in labor. It's the position I can represent labor all my life, turn around and represent industry. That's impossible for me, and I won't do it. I didn't do it. So I absolutely confined myself to the labor movement, with the exception that I did do investing in later years in real estate and business and so forth, and made a hell of a lot more money than labor ever paid me. No comparison at all.
What would you say since the days of the general strike, since 1919, what have been the really major events in this country's history? In the world history.
I don't think you could construe the general strike as having any official status with the country or the world labor problem or at all. I think the general strike's limitation was right about King County, in and around Seattle. And I think if it did anything, it terrifically hurt labor, because it convinced thousands and thousands of people that labor would go for such a structure set up, not knowing where the hell they were going or how to get there. So again, as I said earlier, it demonstrated the weakness in the organization and not the strength.
What have been, I wasn't meaning to include the strike as one of those major events. I mean, since that time though, what have been for you the really significant events that have happened in our country's history?
Outside the labor movement?
Or inside? That have affected the history of this country and maybe of the world?
Well, I think the greatest effect that country has had in its progress and its position in the world can be brought right back and attributed to labor. In other words, I've spoken on this before, maybe 25, 30, 40, or 50 universities, Commonwealth Club, Press Club in Washington, all over the damn United States and Europe. I have pointed out time and time and time again that labor evolved a system of organizational structure that became so powerful that they compelled industry to accept it, regardless of the fact that industry would have liked to destroy it and spent billions of dollars trying to destroy it. They could not destroy it. Now, we're in competition in the United States with the world. We're in competition with Japan and China, England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales, France, everyone you can name. And we were paying wages under the compulsion of labor, far above any other country that you could name. Yet we were selling the product of labor manufactured in this country. Coal is a good illustration of it. I used to sit in the Carlton Hotel with John L. Lewis two or three times a week during the 5 years that I was in Washington as general president. We were very close personal friends. And under the mechanization that took place in the mines, that permitted the mine owners to live and work and pay the miners fine salaries and conditions and so forth, fine in the sense of comparison anywhere else in the world, we were still, because they had to mechanize to do that. The only one way in the world they could do it. They couldn't continue the hand method of handling coal and so forth that they were doing over in England and China or wherever the hell you were. Therefore, in order to mechanize, they had to plow back the earnings out of their invested capital into mechanization. Out of that mechanization, gave a tremendous increase in the unit production of the individual. And it permitted us to lay coal down on the docks around the world cheaper than any other country could do it, regardless of what they paid labor. One plowed it all back into profit, like the British mining industry. And over in this country, in order to live, they had to plow it back into machinery in order to get the unit costs down so labor could be satisfied and the product sold under a mechanization structure. Now, in my opinion, that's the greatest accomplishment in the history of the American our country, and brought about directly, in my opinion, by the compulsion of labor through its organized strength to compel that organization, and then came shorter hours and everything else associated with it.
So it was because of labor's power that employers were forced to mechanize.
Absolutely.
Has that come back in some ways to hurt labor in terms of lost jobs or?
Mine in an individual sense, but no. Because of the interval of that now, it's got such tremendous momentum that the other people had to themselves start to adopt mechanization. Take the automotive industry in Japan, for instance. Take the airplane industry in any country that you want to name, France or anywhere else. They've had to accept mechanization in order to survive. Far removed from coal or those other things. So the result of it is the minute they did that, they created a situation of a competitive nature that led to greater organizing in other countries. And by virtue of it, it not only gave impetus to us here, it continued in far removed from here in the competitive field. You only have to take a look at it from the standpoint. There's a tremendous amount of Japanese cars being sold on our market today. Now, they're under the highest type of mechanization in the manufacture of automobiles in Japan, just as great as we are here. Same thing is true over in West Germany and all down through Italy, wherever they manufacture. So the result of it is now the labor movement has reached the point where one gigantic move on the part of labor, and unless there was wages maintained, comparable to here, you more likely would wreck Toyota and its sales in this Western Hemisphere overnight.
You mean one movement by Japanese labor?
No, by American labor. Let us say now that the automotive industry took the initiative, the personnel employed to manufacture, construction of automobiles, and went into the gigantic public forum through newspapers and magazines and television and radio, through their union halls and et cetera, and contended, what the hell are you doing here buying Toyotas manufactured in Japan at a labor scale far below the United States? What the hell is happening here to American labor, and what's happening to the money that's being spent by American labor in the great market trade of the American government? You could, unless Japan immediately got up there on an equal basis of it, and that couldn't be done too easily, you would shut off hundreds of thousands of Toyota cars coming in here. Now, that's one of the phases of the boycott structure of the American labor movement. And that's one of the things that is being developed to a higher degree of efficiency in the instance where you haven't the militancy that you had in the old days of organizing. You are, for instance, I can look back over the time when you, in the laundry industry, for instance, we organized the drivers and the girls inside that worked at the back end of laundry. You couldn't organize the office employees, the stenographers, the bookkeepers, and all those people. They had a social status in their own mind that they were better off socially than the girls working on the back end of the laundry, even though union conditions sure reached the point shortly where the girls on the back end of the laundry were making anywhere from $5 to $20 a week more than the bookkeepers.
Yeah, I'm trying to my question.
you imagine a general strike happening today?
No. I can imagine it happening, yes. But as being a practical matter, absolutely no. But I really can't visualize it happening at all, because I think there's too much practicality in the operation of the labor movement. And I think it's been demonstrated that wherever it was tried, at best it was a temporary affair, political in nature, and within a very short period of time, whatever effect it had was on the political life and not on the economic life.
So there's no condition that you can think of where you would personally support it or advocate it?
A general strike? No. If you were going to support it, it'd only be if you, in my opinion, if your government had been torn to pieces and to the degree where your government was starting to go apart, rotten to the core, and you were looking at revolution because you couldn't get help through the immediate channels of your democratic system of government. That's the only way I'd even think of it.
So you see it essentially as a political and not an economic
revolution?
When we were talking about it, it was pretty amazing to me how even small details of it you remembered about it. Have you since that time read books on the general strike? Or
No. I don't think I've ever read any books on the general strike, because I lived alongside of it close enough that I knew the inside structure of it, you see. And then I saw the Verona situation up at Everett and the massacre down at Centralia coming out of the Legion fight with the IWW setup. I saw all of those things. They made no impression on me that all had changed my long-term thinking for the labor movement. And I think now, with the passage of time, if the agitation that you find in behalf of general strike will be from a lot of impractical people, theorists, they don't know what the hell it's all about. And they're groping for some way to find solutions, and they give that political expression. But the labor movement today has been built by the powerful structure of well-administered organizations, financially successful in being able to adopt the business method. Now, I talk to universities great, and once in a while to high school. So I back away from talking to high school very much, because you're talking over their heads in the most number of instances. And I point out continually to them the philosophy that I followed in the American Labor Movement, and I was condemned many, many, many times for it. I took the position that heading up a great labor organization was a business. And I would say to the students talking to them, or where I was organizing, in the South or anywhere, I'd say, wait a minute, what in the world have you got to sell in this open competitive market you're talking about? You don't own laundries or bakeries or dairies or trucking companies or grocery stores or anything else. The only thing in the world that you own is your labor. That's all you own. Cut your arms off tomorrow morning and you're more than likely objects of charity immediately. You better have a lot of insurance or you will be. Now, you go out into life, I don't care whether you leave the university or you're compelled to go before you ever get to the university. When you go out to sell whatever you own, it's your labor. That's all you're selling, because you have nothing else to offer. All right, now you join a labor union to sell it under the process of collective bargaining through an organizational structure where you represent the great mass of the people selling it. And therefore, you can compete in the open market with organized industry. Now, you can't compete with the Chamber of Commerce, the Industrial Association, or the American Medical Institute, or anybody else you want to name as an individual. But you band yourselves together here in collective action with a powerful labor union, administered under a business-like mandate, the same as United States Steel or anywhere else. Then you can utilize the resources at your command to the highest possible degree, and you can compete with any part of industry. Most times, more than successfully. Now, they grasp that. Now, with the passage of time, That's slowly been impressed upon us. I've made the statement talking to chambers of commerce and many, many cities. I said, you people right out in front of me that fought union labor all your life, you're the best organizers we ever had. Because you were so indicative, or vindicative rather, that you weren't going to let labor get even to start. Keep them down where you dominated. And you did such a good job of it that you made our work easy. And that's exactly my visualization from the day I started in the labor movement. You take our organizations today, we have some of the most beautiful buildings in America. We pay high salary. Somebody gets up and says to me, well, you're paying Mr. Fitzsimmons or somebody $150,000 a year. I say, well, that's right. You're paying $700,000 or $800,000 or more than that over at the United States Steel Corporation. Now, Mr. Fitzsimmons can't go over and run the United States Steel Corporation. And I'm telling you, 10,000 to 1, the Steel Corporation president can't come over and run the Teamsters Union either. The union will belly up just as fast as the steel company would. We can't all be doctors, we can't all be lawyers, can't all be engineers or architects. We have got to become skillful in the part of our profession, representing the interests of the people that we're selling what they own, whether it's steel or labor. Now, following that pattern, the Teamsters came out of it as the largest labor organization in the world. And it was following that pattern. The only one I ever had. I never went in agreeing with anybody that you had to get out here and espouse political issues and all that sort of stuff. I said, I'm here selling labor. I'm interested in politics. I'm interested in the moral question. And I'm interested in the profession of medicine and et cetera and et cetera. But my primary job is selling this man's labor. That's what I'm here for. And I intend to build an organization under an administrative procedure that'll sell it in the open market against the onrush of any opposition by any part of industry, no matter how large or small they are. And we have successfully done it. Now we've got the momentum, and there's no reason why we should lose it. We will not lose it unless we get thousands and thousands of people who say, oh, what the hell, we don't have to do these things no more. It's for the same reason I say you can't afford to be so overzealous that we're going to live in peace for the rest of our life, that we're going to sit down here and accept promises from Russia or any other form of government that don't agree with our form of government. And we've got to have an army, we've got to have a navy, we've got to have a Marine Corps. I hope the hell the day comes when none of us have to have it. But I sure as hell don't advocate the abolition of it, waiting for that day to come based upon somebody's promise that we won't need it. I don't believe that.
What do you see as you say now the labor movement has the momentum up. What do you see some sort of end goal for the labor movement? Is there an end goal? Or
the only possible end goal that can be for labor in our government or any other is to get the highest possible return that's fair and equitable in the distribution of the dollar that's spent by the consumer in the open markets of trade. That's all. No other place to go. Now, you can't get it out of an industry where the profit's not in it. That leads to bankruptcy. You can get it better in a high-paying industry with as much margin than you can in another. Only temporarily, however, because under our competitive structures, the people that see that profitable position, they've got their eye on it to be competitors within the industry itself. I say that what you're fighting for all the time is to get your fair share of the profit of any industry you work in. Now, some will be more profitable than others, at least temporarily.
The last question I have is, when someone just said to you, well, I hear you were in Seattle during the 1919 general strike, what was it like? Do you have a mental picture? I mean, what's the first thing you think of when you think of that strike?
Well, the knowledge that I've acquired in the interval of that time and now, and looking back on it, I see a lot of damn fools running in all directions, not knowing where the hell they were going. That's all I see. And I don't see any of the philosophy that they advocated being an effect today in the leading form of any kind of character. Now, much of the things that the radical of 30 years ago was fighting to get, we've got it today, and everybody accepts it. But you got to have timing, too. You got to have it in business, you got to have it in government, you have to have it in every phase of our economic or business organization. So timing becomes as important as the advocacy of the thing itself. How many years it take us to get Social Security? We're behind all of Europe on it. But eventually, one of the reasons that retarded us was we were doing a far better job as an individual earner in our ability to purchase it than they were over in Europe.
Because it wasn't as great a social need for it, because people individually
were right.
Doing better.
Right.
Well, I have.
You're really an amazing person.
I guess. What do you mean, amazing?
Well,
you want to take that book and read it?
Sure.
Why don't you send it back to me?
Great. Thank you.
I think that with the work you're doing to get your degree, now this is a very able fellow, and I'm sure that you'll get a lot from it, on what you're trying to do here. You get it and send it back to me here at 1017.
Great, I'll keep my eye out for them also. There are all these conferences always going on of West Coast academics together, and now that I know who he is, I'll keep my eye out for him.
You read that. I think it'll help you on what you're doing.
Great. And I hope that in a week or two, I'll give you a call.
All right.
Coming back for I promise, brief.
That's all right. That's all right. Don't worry about that. I'm busy, but not that.
Uh-huh.
I'm tickled to death to do it for you. Definitely. Like I did for the fellow wrote that book.
Thank you very much.
I gave it for near. I give almost to. 3 weeks, sir, 8 hours a day.
Oh, well, I should be asking more of you then.
That's right.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
So long.